That was one of the weirdest beginnings of a podcast I've ever not published. And if you're listening to this, you won't have heard the last 2.5 minutes of me trying to humbly introduce my very good friend that is Josh Connolly, about to be a Sunday Times best-selling author, globally published author with a new book out, It's Them, Not You, published in China, Japan, Burkina Faso and France. But amongst all of these things, yes, he's a breathwork facilitator. Yes, he's a resilience coach. He's coached companies as big as Dyson and as small as Unknown, my tiny creative recruitment company. Amongst all of these things, he is also my top 15 friend after the last 2.5 minutes. Friend, personal coach. I would say mainly you are just a good fucking solid friend of mine. And I invited you on today. Yes, because you have a book. Hold it up for our wonderful fans and
this
listeners.
This is my lovely book.
This is his lovely book. Number one, I wanted to talk about that and kind of get into why you've decided to write a book apart from for capitalistic reasons. number two, I also wanted to explore something that I think is coming up a lot in our world, which is around masculinity. And the third is actually more personal to my business and also to anyone that is running and building a team. How, in this world of 2024, do we build high-performance teams without crushing their souls? Josh Connolly, I'm not going to ask you how you are. I'm going to get straight to the point. Why did you write... Pass me the book, sorry, just very, very quickly. Thank you, sir. Why did you write a book called It's Them, Not You, How to Break Free from Toxic Parents and Reclaim Your Story?
Look, mate... I think it's one of the biggest taboos in Western culture, at least, where if you've grown up with somebody, look, I think everybody recognizes and realizes that horrible people exist. If you say to anybody, do you know some really sort of toxic, have you ever met anybody who's sort of really toxic and horrible? Mm. Everybody will be able to list quite a few people normally. And many of them are parents. And I think that we all have varying degrees of toxicity, from really toxic, sort of horrible or abusive people, right down to the average one of us who come with our own traits. And I think that what you grow up with shapes who you are today. And look, I believe from the work that I've done, I think a lot of the most successful people in the world are driven by what originated as dysfunction.
What does that mean? So what, when you say dysfunction, kid growing up in a household, I imagine they're like, there's either a broken family or whatever. How do you define what a dysfunction is?
Again, I think dysfunction is probably the norm. And I think I would argue there's probably no such thing as a functional family. And we all grow up with varying different degrees of dysfunction. And I think because we are so emotionally inept in Western culture, we're so terrified of difficult and uncomfortable emotions. We're so emotionally illiterate, right? And I'm choosing my words carefully here, by the way. Like, I'm not, what I'm saying might sound quite polarizing, but I believe it to be true. It's very, very difficult to talk about the negative impacts of your childhood without people becoming very uncomfortable. So you can have grown up with varying different levels of dysfunction in your childhood, but still have a very loving, close relationship with a parent.
Mm.
But dare you talk about the impact of those experiences when you were a child and the negative impact that they had on you, which is in a lot of cases the reality and the truth for some people, you'll often always be shut down, told that it's, you'll be force-fed, they did their best, and, you only get one mum and dad. And look, perspective can be useful in many instances, but actually we need to get to the crux and the truth of our experience and then work back from there.
I've done therapy recently. I did about 10 to 12 sessions. And one of the things that came up, I don't mind saying this, was around one of my parents. And it's really weird. I would say like, oh, but she didn't mean, and yeah. I before even saying the thing that had happened, I'd write, well, no, that wasn't her intention. She had a really hard life at that time. And da-da-da-da-da. I feel conditioned to say that because I know that my mother isn't a horrible person. She's a lovely, down-to-earth, flamboyant human being. So I almost felt quite guilty exploring the idea that I had been negatively impacted by an upbringing where she was just doing her best. You know, she was a single parent, dad wasn't around. Because that's, I think, the thing. By the way, I shared the book, and my mum wrote, she wrote to me and went, "Did you think I was a toxic parent?" So, and I had to say, "Yes, yeah, I did." I said, I had to say, you know, no, it's, you know, Josh is really a friend of mine, but, you know, I have done therapy and we've explored different things, and, you know, there is a part of me that feels guilty in mm-hmm. almost identifying the part of her doing her best wasn't good enough or impacted me in a bad way.
Yeah.
Do people say that to you a lot?
Yeah, well, it's really, really common. It's really common, and it's something that I think is sort of relatively natural. Even, you know, like you're talking about a good, loving parent who did her best, and sometimes the best had a negative impact on you. Mm. I think if you were like to take a physical variation of that, right? I always use an example of, I may have said this to you before actually, but if I tripped and accidentally dropped a brick on your foot, right? You could understand that it was an accident and it wasn't my fault, but you'd still have to go to the hospital and get your foot sorted out, right? And when you got to the hospital, you wouldn't want to be like, well, I'm not really going to tell them the truth because I don't want to make my, you know, make them look bad.
Yeah.
You'd say, look, they dropped it. It was an accident. So parenting's the hardest thing anyone will ever do. You'll make mistakes. And I think as I'm a parent myself, there will be parts of themselves that my children, when they reach their adulthood, and some of them nearly have, where they will have to explore where I let them down.
How would you, if you were to speak to your children or somebody that was about to go through that journey, what would you say in how to communicate with you about that? As your children, how can they approach a conversation with you to say, oh, Dad, I've discovered this thing about me, which is, I think, down to this thing that happened in my childhood?
It's not about how they would approach it, it's about how I would approach it, isn't it?
Yeah.
Am I willing to witness that? Am I willing to have my kids say, you know what, you were pretty emotional avoidant, or I felt like you put your phone before me sometimes, and I felt like I wasn't good enough because you were on your phone too much when I was a child. And that by the way, that's a real life example that I'm giving you. So I have to witness that. I have to be able to witness that. So I need to not do the same thing that everybody does, which is jump on them. Yeah, but I loved you, man. It wasn't because I didn't have much. It's more, I wasn't good enough. That must have been that fucking must have been horrible for you, yeah, and would have shaped part of who you are. And that's not easy, man. Yeah. But what people need is truth. And to just come back to a question that I don't think I answered that you sort of did bring up, what is dysfunction? Dysfunction is when the truth is swept under the carpet and the child in the house is not given the safety and the opportunity to explore its true meaning. So if a child, let me give you like a real life example that probably happens in every home. If I have an argument with my wife in the kitchen, we've just had a bit of an argument. My daughter, my youngest is 6, but say when she was a little bit younger, 4 or 5, she walks in, she used to do this. She goes, stop it. And I go, if I'm not emotionally awake, I sweep everything under the carpet and I go, don't be silly, everything's fine. What are you talking about? We're all right. Like, there's nothing to worry about here. And so I teach my daughter that what you're feeling's wrong when it was right, that's her intuition, her body's picked up on something. I teach her that it's wrong and to sweep it under the carpet. She doesn't have an adult's rational brain where she can go, fucking hell, something was going on in here and he don't want to talk about it.
Yeah.
She goes, oh, why do I, something wrong with me? I don't, like, I could have sworn there was an argument going on.
Yeah.
I really, you know, and this won't be conscious, but I don't trust my body. Whereas the flip side of that is if I go, you know what? Me and your mum have just fallen out, actually. What you're picking up on, which is really, really clever, your body can sense that something's a bit off. Maybe it's a subtle facial movement, but you can sense it. That's really good. We have had an argument. And, it doesn't mean that we don't love each other. It doesn't mean that we've fallen out. But it's great that you sensed it.
God, you can see why people don't do that. Because even, like, watching you say that, seems like so much. What's easier, right? Path of least resistance for the brain.
Yeah.
Nothing, shut up, go play, go watch TV versus you are correct. And now I could be potentially making you worried or scared or changing your emotion. It's hard.
It's hard. And let me just caveat that by saying, like, I'm giving you that example knowing that I do the first thing a lot.
Yeah.
And even though I've written this book and I talk about, I know I do the first thing a lot.
Yeah.
So where am I in my life? The best I can, creating space to have those conversations with my kids. To say to them, you know, you really need to trust your body. And we live in this world now because in the UK particularly, but I think it's true in Western culture, we're like chronic people pleasers, right? And we bring these kind of ideologies that may have made sense once upon a time, but don't work in the world today. Like, you know, never judge anyone. Now, I understand the notion, like try not to judge people. Try not to be a judgmental prick, yeah? Mm. But also, you absolutely should judge people. When you're around somebody new, you should listen to your body, feel a sense of what you pick up on it, and then make a judgment of whether that person should or shouldn't be in your life. Yeah. Like, you fucking should do that. Yeah. I want my kids to do it. I don't want my kids to ignore their body and love everybody and pretend that everybody's love and light because they fucking ain't.
You're switching off your instincts.
Yeah, exactly. And you're not supposed to like and love everybody. Mm. You're not supposed to have everybody like and love you. And if you do, you want to look at that shit, really.
Are you being who you really are? Or are you being who you want people, who you think people want you to be?
Exactly. And I think, listen, both me and you, and I don't want to speak out of turn here, we know what it's like to be a social chameleon. It's a great, it's a great trait to be able to have in the work that we do. But it's also problematic, isn't it? Trying to get you liked by everyone or leave you feeling alone, man.
Yeah.
And we've both been there to some degree. Feeling, you know what I mean? Like, nobody knows who I am because we don't show anyone.
Mm. So when someone reads this book and they put it down, what are you hoping will be different about their life as they go forward?
I think they'll have a better understanding of who they are. And they will have a better ability to be in their body and trust what they think and feel.
So you're not saying to everybody, read this book, go meet with your mum and tell her she was not right and she was not fair.
Yeah.
Because I think that's probably, if I was to create content for this book, I would probably create things that resonated with people to make them feel like, I know you've been told by everybody around you that you should, you know, you've only got one mum or one dad and you should, you know, unconditionally support and respect everything that they have done for you. but that is not how you have to live your life. I'd probably see that content and I'd watch half of it. I wouldn't buy the book. And I'd go, oh, I'm going to fucking message my mum and tell her, you know. Because I think that's the, you know, the issue with these things. Like, people already read the first line and go, oh, yeah, that's, now I feel like I can hold my parents responsible for all of the chaos I've created in this world. But that's not what you're saying.
No.
You're saying, read this, be aware of the impact that that has had on your life, give yourself empathy for that situation, and hopefully course correct and change.
Yeah, and but you have to, you do have, I believe that you have to start at a point of realizing so much of the pain that you carry in yours.
In what way?
You're carrying your parents' pain. Because, look, when you're born, yeah, you are of value straight away, right? No child is born or should be born and then have their parent go, you know what, if you go on to be somebody, I'll really love you. Mm. Like, a parent should be instantly, entirely, completely in love with who you are. Why? Because your value exists because you exist. Self-love's not something you should go on and teach. You don't teach self-love. You're shown that when you're a child. Right, by a parent who can be emotionally available for you to let you know that you're lovable when you're happy, sad, lonely, jealous, rageful, all of those things. I'm here for you and I love you all the same, no differently. But most kids don't do that, don't get that, because they have a parent who can't be emotionally available in all of those things because they haven't done the work on themselves that's needed to be there. So then when you grow up feeling like you're not lovable, it's not because you haven't done the right thing. It's not because your business ain't got big enough. It's not because you ain't made enough friends. Because your value and your lovability is innate. Mm. So the fact that you think you're not lovable to any varying degree was never yours to carry. It was someone else's. You will pass it on to your kids and to the next generation. Pain travels down through families until somebody's not only willing to feel it, but willing to take responsibility for it.
That's really interesting. I saw this thing on Instagram with like coffee being poured into.
Yeah, tea. I keep getting sent it. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Did you send me it?
No, I don't. Well, maybe I did.
No, you just send me dodgy memes.
No, but it was, well, for the purpose of me now, you know, boring you with the same thing again. 4 cups of water, 1 cup of coffee on the right side. Pour the coffee into the water. It's pretty much like the same color as the coffee originally.
Yeah.
And then pour that water into the next water. The water's diluting, but it's still staying pretty like murky and brown until the end, which is like you were just saying, you know, that person then goes and does the work, figures out what this pain was and da 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 da. The coffee is meant to represent the idea of generational trauma being passed through generations. And because nobody is stopping and doing this kind of work, reading these kind of books, it just gets passed on and passed on.
Yeah.
So is there, like, with this book, right? So it's like identification. This is how I imagine, I've not read it. It's acknowledge and identify that there has been some impact of trauma that's happened to you. And we could say trauma with a little T or a big T. It's happened in some kind of way. Then what are you expecting someone to do after they've acknowledged? Is there an adaption? Is there like, what happens?
Then you go on a journey to understand yourself.
Right.
So you recognize that this didn't start with you, right? This isn't yours. Mm. Right? You justify and validate your experiences. You're not crazy. There's never been anything wrong with you. You've been reacting to the world the best way that you know how based on the experiences that you had when you were younger. Then all the work is on you. So you start first. We start with self-compassion. The way that you find self-compassion is to fully and adequately see all of the mistakes and the difficult things that you've done in your life. Mm. So this is wholly then, right? Once we've established that this didn't start with you, it's then your responsibility now, right? You're going to stand up, you're going to step into your power, and you're going to say it stops with me. And it might not be in your fault, but it's your responsibility now. So self-compassion comes when I look into my soul, I look at all the mistakes that I've made, and I let them go. I write them down, I look at what I was doing, look at the patterns that I was driven by, and there's exercises in the book to do all of this. Mm. What was driving me? Was it fear, insecurity, a desperate desire to be lovable? I work all of them out, and then I give myself the opportunity to free myself from that. It's easy to love yourself when you've just done the big thing.
Mm.
But then you realize that you go straight back to where you were when the big thing loses a little bit of its thing, yeah?
Yeah.
Can you love yourself when you just fucked up? When you just done the bad thing? Well, can you find love then? Then once you've done that, then you go on to understand all of the different parts of you that exist, that you're not crazy, that different parts of you have protected you throughout of your life. And then you look at healing those past relationships. I say, how close to the fire can you sit without getting burnt? Some people cut their losses with their parent because their parent's so horrible. Mm. Some people will adjust their expectations. Maybe you have an emotionally unavailable parent. It's not your job to change them. It's not your responsibility to change them. You have no power to change them. If you want a relationship with them, you need to adjust your expectations and have the relationship with them they're able to have with you. Mm. And if that's one where you don't talk about emotions, you have a decision to make.
Yeah.
That ain't for me to make. If you think, well, if they can't be emotionally responsible, I don't want to be, that's your decision. But maybe you think, you know what? Maybe I can see them. Maybe we can not talk about emotions, and maybe I can build a new relationship in that way.
Mm.
And then finally, you complete a relationship with yourself, which is where you look internally, the part of you, that little version of yourself that you locked away and built a big brick wall around when you were a child. How do you go back, revisit that, and make it feel safe in the person that you are today?
So nice to hear it in that sequence, because I've done all of this with you.
Mm.
I even remember when maybe more of an experimental time of your coaching where you got me to write a letter. You made me write a letter to my parent.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was like, okay, cool, what do I do with that? You were like, I'll burn it. I was like, all right, okay, cool, burn it. And then you said, now write the letter back from the parent. And that was the weirdest thing, because you suddenly have this understanding of where the trauma and the pain and you find empathy in the deepest and weirdest places when you're writing it as if it was you.
Yeah.
And I remember then, you know, the thing that I took from that as an action and took from that as a kind of an adaption of how I was in that relationship was, yeah, as you said, expectations of the relationship. And then figuring out, okay, well, which parts of me aren't met, which needs aren't met.
Yeah.
And then I'm, ever since doing that, I'm very much, I'm okay with it all. Like,
you've adjusted your expectations and have the relationship that the person's able to have with you.
Yeah, and there's almost a bit of a quirky, like, oh, I love that about you because you are so emotionally avoidant. Like, yeah. I can say that, and I can say that without going, and that therefore has made me feel like a people pleaser, and you know, my life as I've gone on. I don't need to say it.
You made your peace with it. That's in the book, by the way. That exercise is in the book, yeah.
Okay. I feel like I'm really happy with the level of plugging of the book now. So I'm going to move the hell on. All right. I want to talk to you about masculinity, Josh. Problem going on in the world. Everyone speaks about there are no people for young guys to look up to. You've got Andrew Tate. You've got all this kind of stuff floating around, right? There's an epidemic, apparently. I can't give you stats, but I can tell you that if you speak to any man and you speak about the generation coming through, nobody has any idea of what we need to do to make sure that they can become men that are confident in their shoes, can speak out. I feel like there is a silent thing happening to that generation where maybe because of the generations before them and the men that existed before them have been part of the Me Too brigade.
Yeah.
All of the shit that blokes have done. People like Donald Trump existed, right? Mm-hmm. I think because of that, the next generation of men don't know who they should be, could be, and therefore how to act. Not just towards their own lives, but also towards women and or men if they're interested in men. Like, I think there's confusion on a mass scale for young men. And I don't know many people that know what to do about that.
So firstly, look, I sort of agree that we're in a bit of a weird place with it all. I've always, and I maintain this, if we created adequate spaces for young people to truly explore who they were, the whole masculinity, men, gender conversation would be completely different because everybody would be supported and given space into discovering exactly who they are. I think we live in a world now of like polarization more than ever. I think it's probably always been a little bit like that. But we live in a world now of like, there's two things that go on. There's the world of polarization, which is like, you either love it or you hate it. There's no in between. When the reality is that the answer is normally both. In nearly every answer to every question is both, right? So there's that aspect of it. And then the second aspect of it is that we live in a world where people's opinions are part of their brand now.
Mm.
And so you have the version of all of the people that you know that you see on LinkedIn, and then the version that, and you can literally see somebody go, oh, did you see that post about the masculinity post on LinkedIn? Yeah, I commented on it. And you go, oh, yeah, I saw your comment on there. And they'd be like, yeah, I mean, I actually think that X, Y, or Z. I mean, I know I put it was fucking ABC, but I'll probably think it's X, Y, Z. And people are like, there's this kind of open knowing now that we have our outward facing version of ourselves, and then we have what we actually believe that goes on over here and when we chat about it. And I think that's a huge problem.
Mm.
So when you bring those two things together, the point I'm trying to make is that, like, look, I think men have had the balance of power for a long time. I think it's been hugely problematic, the Me Too stuff. I think there's loads in all of that. And I think there's still room for chivalry. I think we need to, like with everything, we need to try and get back to the middle here.
Yeah.
Like, in my loving relationship, in my marriage, I probably bring all of what's seen as the feminine traits to our marriage, and my wife does all of what's probably seen as masculine traits, but like, to a certain degree. And we have a joint bank account, but I still know that when we're out having dinner, I like to be the one at the end that gets it's our money in the same account, but gets the card out and pays for it all and takes the receipt and puts it in my pocket. And I don't think when I have that feeling, it's about control and power. I think it's about feeling like I'm accomplishing, treating, in my case, my wife, but I really don't think it would matter whatever gender they were, that I'm treating them to something to eat, you know? And like, you should be able to feel like proud about that. And then lastly, before I like let you come back at me with it, I think we have to speak the truth of what it's like to be a boy and a man. Like, nobody talks about the fact that when you go through puberty, when you hit about 13, 14, you can't think about anything else but your knob and women.
Yeah.
I know you laugh, but it's true, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, for, or your knob and whoever, whatever you, sex you're attracted to.
Yeah.
That happens when you're 13, 14.
It's a new part of your brain that's evolving.
Yeah, and it's hard, man, because it's all you think about. And you might, like, I got told throughout my fucking, until I went through puberty, I was told, you know, oh, he's going to be a heartbreaker. The girls are going to love him. He's going to have all the girls around him. And then the moment I could actually do something about that, I was told, you fucking stay away from girls. Don't you go near them. So it's confusing, man.
Yeah.
It's confusing. And so, like, we have to have more open, honest conversations about the truth of that, not virtue signaling what's going to get me liked and loved most by people. There you go. Back that back at you. That was a very long answer.
There's like three elements to the answer, right? I think I could, the easiest thing I can do is look at the last thing. Like, how... So what do we say? What's the solution to that? Is it more spaces for that 13 or 14-year-old to talk about the feelings that he's experiencing? Do you know what's really fucked about this? Is that... Let's say I made my mission helping little boys become more sexually aware of themselves.
Uh-huh.
Even saying that out loud sounds fucking weird.
Yeah.
So, like, it's almost, there's a moat again, right? Where it's almost like, well, someone needs to help them, but I don't want to be the guy that says I'm going to do it. Like, I think there's also that element to it where you've got this, I don't know, it's not exactly, it's not fashionable to then say that you're the guy that's going to help the young boys.
And it's uncomfortable, isn't it?
I'm finding it uncomfortable to say it out loud.
Well, yeah, because even then when I were like, I knew I was on one, when I'm on a bit of a rant, I say stuff and then start to feel uncomfortable about it afterwards. But even when I say the whole, like, when you get to 14 and all you can think about is your knob and what you're going to do with it, like, it feels uncomfortable, but it's the truth.
Yeah.
And then also you've got, like, let's take that a step further with the internet and the world today. Unless somebody talks to young boys about sex properly, they're going to think that it's all doggy style and like emptying it on their back and like what they see on porn, because nobody else. So that's where they're going to learn about sex.
Yeah.
And unless anybody tells them any different, they're only going to learn through experience. And then when you're a young boy and you're watching this stuff on porn and you feel like you can't live up to that, it's confusing, man.
Also, not even just sexually as well, like with the relationships and the dynamics of relationships and, you know, the chivalry thing, and that again is confusing for anyone that's coming through, because, you know, you could be told not every female or girl wants to be treated like that, and you go, shit, well then how do I, what's the, they used to be very clean cut, I think.
Yeah.
If I open the door for the lady, she goes first, and I don't know, I think because of this, the world where we're trying to open everything up and become inclusive of all different genders and sexualities, it must be incredibly overwhelming to know which one you are and then therefore how you need to act with.
And then there's even more layers in there, right? Of, what do they call it? There's a term of something like, is it beauty bias or attractive bias?
I thought it was pretty privilege. No, that's not.
Well, all of that stuff. But what I'm on about is like, what's okay for like the quote unquote Western idea of what ugly and awkward is.
Yeah.
Right, it might not be okay for them, but if you're really charismatic and a bloody good looker, you probably can do a little bit of looking at people and holding the door open.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, like, that's going to be really an unpopular thing to say.
No, you're right.
But it's also the truth.
Yeah.
So that's why we need to, like, try and find ways to speak about the truth, as uncomfortable as it is. Like, that's the reality. Same as... Everybody says, you know, we want emotionally available men and, like, we want them to cry. And Will Smith's probably a bad example because he went on to do what he did. But I don't know, like, his girlfriend sort of, or his wife said that she cheated on him live on TV and he cried his fucking eyes out. And it was a meme for years online of him crying.
Wow, I didn't know that.
He was crying on this TV program that he did with his wife, and it was a meme for ages. Wow. Ronaldo cried a couple of weeks ago, last week in the Euros. Fucking, he just got battered the next day.
Really?
So it's all like, yeah, cry, man, be more open to cry. And then when people are doing it, they just get absolutely hammered for it.
Yeah, the crying thing. It's funny. I find it really hard to be like that emotional.
Mm.
And I've never really known. I'm quite an emotional person. You know, I speak a lot. I say like I love you to my friends and really open about the positive side of emotion. Less able to cope with my own negative or sad and melancholic, we'll say.
Yeah.
I can't even fucking find the right words to describe sadness.
Yeah, yeah.
I find like I can't cry during a film. I'd find it really weird if I started crying during a film.
What, even Green Mile?
Yeah, I'd make a joke.
Have you seen
about that mouse deserve to die? Yeah.
But no, I get it. And but by the way, that comes back to the childhood stuff again, by the way.
Yeah.
And then you bring in the whole sort of mother-father wound.
Mm.
Lots of boys are trying to get the love of a mum. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then what impact does that have on who they are? Go on.
No, I was going to say, I just don't know where what needs to happen? Like, what kind of movement needs to happen so this podcast ages terribly? Imagine this goes out and, like, you go back to this 2005.
What we need is honesty. The starting point should always be honesty.
Mm.
Say the thing.
Mm.
Say what you think and then work back. And that's harder than ever in today's world.
Yeah.
Because... like, bring your... And some of the things that I've said might be wholly naive.
Mm.
If you're into feminism or into looking at masculinity, they might be wholly naive. Mm. And it should be, like, great. As long as I'm willing to listen to people, don't get defensive or be attacked. If somebody says to me, well, that thing you said about, like, young boys and thinking about their knob and, like, that's ridiculous because of X, Y, Z, I might go, oh...
Oh, I didn't think about it like that.
Yeah.
But at least we've started something here.
But you have to start at that place of, like, honesty, you know? Like, and then, by the way, when you look at the polarizing characters, you have to, you can't just shut them down and disagree with everything that they say.
Mm.
You know, you look at it like the Andrew Tate thing, and it's like, everybody just wants to say he's a knob and shut him down, and if you like him, then you're a misogynist and a bigot. And listen, I don't like the guy myself, yeah? But we should be looking at why so many people are into him and what they're finding in him.
Yeah.
And what I think you invariably find is actually they don't wholly agree with everything he says.
No.
But there's a few bits in there that they do and nobody else is letting them hold those opinions.
No.
So when you silence people's true opinions, they become rife for being groomed into having polarized opinions. Because Andrew Tate will go... yeah, let me take that. You want to hold doors open for the women? That's all right. And then he'll give you all of his extreme views as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But he's the only one that's listening to your actual needs.
Yeah.
So people are drawn in by that. Of course they are.
Why can't we have someone like that that doesn't come with the rest of the package? But I guess you're right because
he wouldn't do well on social media.
No. And again, that needs investigating as to what it is. And I think that's what I saw about the big following of 18-year-old or whatever they are, kid, like young boys, is there's not really anybody else that's waving the flag of it's okay to have these feelings, da 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 da. I think that's what I'll end up, if I ever made my millions and felt economically secure, I think that feels like a deep calling to do something about that for younger men. I want to move on from younger men.
Just quickly, let me finish on saying, by the way, one thing that we have to do is there's no right or wrong way of being a man.
Mm.
So if I take my stepdad for an example, he's a bricklayer, very sort of like, you know, doesn't really do emotions, what you might call an old school man. He's a lovely man, but his version of what it is to make him a man is wholly different to mine. Neither are right or wrong, man.
Mm.
Like, my job should not be to try and open him up like a tin of tuna and make him emotional and open to all of that shit, because that's not who he is. So let him be, man. Let people be. If nobody's hurting, if they're not hurting anyone and they're happy, why have you got to try and make him the version of a man that you think's right?
Ooh, interesting.
Just let people be, man.
Yeah. Because I think I've gone too far. Like, I was at a wedding the other day and I was like, we need to have a conversation. And, you know, I'm jamming this fucking emotional opening up ceremony on somebody because I to be fair, I do think they are struggling. And they were thankful and we had a really good conversation. We left there going, cool, you've got some cool things to focus on now. I tried the exact same thing with my other friend and he was like, I don't need this. I don't want this.
Yeah.
I'm happy. Yes, I'm probably drinking too much, but I honestly don't think I have the things that you think I have.
Yeah.
Let me crack on.
Yeah, why are you trying to open me up?
And he said quite passionately, like, not everybody wants to speak about these problems. Like, just let them do what they're doing. I'm happy. And, like, stop trying to make me out like I'm sad.
Yeah.
And I think that took... I'm relatively self-aware. That took me a couple of, like, sleeps to figure out, fuck, I need to just, like, let people just, you know, figure their own stuff out. Like...
Mm.
You can't fix all these. You can't claim that you're trying to fix and bring these. Not everyone needs to be emotionally led, I think, is the realization. Some people can. You know, you hear these stories about old men that died, never spoke about the war or, you know.
Yeah.
And they were, you know, you would never have thought it. Because they were happy. They got shit done. Okay, maybe gardened a bit too often or they mowed the lawn before it was even. But they had their way of coping.
And they found a way of making sense of their life and their pain.
Yeah.
And that's what we all want. I'm a deeply emotional person, yeah? So I'm always going to be... bit like you, ruminating, unpacking, all that kind of stuff. I look at my stepdad or even my older brother. Not the same person, man.
No.
So why would I try and open him up and operate on him? You don't. It's too much risk in it.
Which brings me on to my third point.
It does. Very nice segue.
Very nice segue. So I have a 12 to 15, depending on which day it is, person business. High performing. Or at least my goal is to get them to be high-performing, healthy, happy, high-earning humans. A lot of H's in that little sentence. Sometimes I think I'm getting it right. And then other times I'm not. And the consistency of high performance is a really hard thing I think every leader struggles to achieve. And I'll be really honest, I'll say the thing. I think I doubled down too hard on mental health in the early phases of my business. And what I mean by that is, I think we spoke so much about mental health that it became a thing that everyone was permitted to put in front of getting their work done. And that was a problem because I was the one waving a flag going, you can't do your job today, you're having a bad... That's fine. Stay in bed. Stay at home. We all have mental health. And, oh, you haven't hit target this quarter for the third quarter in a row. That's fine. Stay at home. You know, take it easy. Do whatever you need to do to get over your problems. That you'll always have a job here. What that ended up creating is a company of mediocre performance, and that ends up becoming a problem because the company can't stay alive and if it carries on that way. But more worryingly, the unsaid, what's the word I'm looking for? The unsaid fucking frustration that builds in people who are high performers that have been almost duct taped across the mouth because they don't want to say the wrong thing, which is, why are we not all working as hard as we should? Why are we not doing what we have to do to make this company thrive as a business? Because they're scared of someone going, you can't say that. Because they've got mental health problems, which at some points 50% of the company could have had. What's going on, Josh?
So look, firstly, I'd agree with you and probably argue that I probably played a little bit of a role in that with you.
Yeah.
I probably did, man.
Yeah.
And I think like when I look at like the ways that I work with people over the years, it's changed. And it's a bit like some of the things that we've already touched on, right? Which is like... nobody ever created a space for me to explore my emotions. And it went on for so long and so much of my life and caused so much problem that my antidote was to go to polarize the other way.
Yeah.
If you create space for people to explore their emotions all of the time, da, da, da. And I think it becomes a little bit problematic. I think that, and listen, I'll be the first, sorry, my phone's not on. Do not disturb it. I'll be the first to promote the idea of exploring the ways that you feel. I think it's important. I think you should create space in your life. I do think that you also have to do a certain amount of putting things back in its box.
Yeah.
And actively, with awareness, suppressing it. I think we're built that way to do that. I'm reading a book at the moment called Bad Therapy. I can't remember who it's by. I don't like the lady that's written it. I started writing it, reading it, because I disagreed with her. I still venomously disagree with a lot of what she's saying. But she's also making some good
you
points.
You should be honest about how you feel about that person.
No, by the way, I'm sure she's... did I say I don't like her?
You said venomously.
No, don't like some of the things that she said.
Oh, yeah, no, you disagree with the stuff you said.
Yeah. Like she's probably a lovely lady.
Well, like, I don't like her, but I think what you...
I might have said I don't like her, but what I mean is I don't like what she's about. I'm sure she's a great person. I'd love to sit and have a conversation with her. Because I also agree with some of the stuff that she's saying. And if you bring your mate in that you just said, there's a term, and I've forgotten what it is, but it's like isogenic or something. That's wrong. That's the wrong word. But there's a term in like the physical health space, which is like, if your appendix were sore and a little bit infected, we wouldn't straight away cut you open and do surgery, because there's a isogenic risk every time. They call it something, but there's a risk every time.
Yeah, you can't.
So we don't just go, let's just open you up and have a look in there and pull out whatever's in there. Because there'd be a risk with the operation. You could have complications. It could kill you.
Yeah.
So we're always weighing up the risk of operating on you, doing whatever surgery it is. We're weighing that up against the risk. And there's always a risk. And the same is true with emotions and the ways that we feel. There's a, like, so when we say everybody should go to therapy, we may do well to question that. If I say to you, how are you feeling? I'm all right, man. I've got a little bit of shit going on, but I'm all right. I sort of tend to enjoy my life. I'm happy in my family. Job's going all right. There's always a slight risk that going to therapy is going to open up the fucking can of worms and you've got a problem that was never there. So there's always that risk. So you should always like question, well, if you're all right, man, don't look at you. Maybe you don't need to look at it. Do you understand?
Yeah.
And I think sometimes what we do with the way that we now frame everything, I really struggled with my mental health last week when we were busy at work. No, you didn't. You were busy at work and your body was fucking stressed. Like, that's not struggling with your mental health. Your body's doing exactly what it needs to do, which is like tell you that that was a bit much so that you fucking don't go off and hammer it the weekend. But what that does when we frame everything, I think, as struggling mental health, which is not what it, which is really problematic, we then take away any personal responsibility. Because if you felt, if your mental health was struggling at the end of a busy week, if you framed that as what it actually is like I was really stressed and overwhelmed and my body was giving every signal it could for me to relax and have a chilled out weekend. If you then went on the piss, because all your mates were going out and you didn't want to say no and you had FOMO and you didn't want to miss out and then you didn't sleep all weekend. And now when you go in on Monday, I'm still struggling with my mental health from last week. What's going on here? Is it work? Or did you not listen to your body? And listen, if you want to go out on the weekend and that's your prerogative, great. But you're not a high performer then. But don't be in the game. Go in another game. Get another job. And this might sound polarizing, and then we'll always bring, you know, some people can't change their jobs, and I understand all of that shit. But if you can't change, like, life's hard, man. It's hard for everyone. And the work that I find myself doing with companies now is about saying, look, how do we make the micro changes in your life? Do you want to be successful? Because despite some of these fucking successful entrepreneurs online who then start sharing quotes about your well-being is more important than anything, is it? You didn't fucking build a massive successful business keeping your well-being in check. If saying that if it costs your mental health, then it costs too much. If that's true, no one's having kids because the first 2 years are hell. So we have to be realistic, man. Do you understand what I'm saying?
What I like about what you just said is that there's so many people... I've been that person probably going... I remember I used to have a life coach and I'd meet her every Monday and I go, I don't like Mondays. And she'd be like, yeah, no, that's fair enough. I don't like Mondays either. What she didn't ask me was, how many pints did you have at the weekend?
Yeah.
25. Like, that's what, and by the way, for every Monday that we've had was probably the case on those weekends. yeah, you get yourself into this cycle, and then you see, and you don't blame the thing that you've been using as medication, which in that sense was alcohol. In other senses, it could be work. You know, some people use work to medicate from overstress at work. Mm. And I think we don't look at the things that, as you said, are saying, hello, address me right now, and don't blame the thing that's kind of paying your bills right now. It's interesting because that's a really polarizing viewpoint for you to have, given the fact that your income, you know, a part of it is coming from companies that are going to bring you in and get a room to speak about their struggles and their mental health.
And what I talk about in these, and listen, right, I've given you like one end of the spectrum there. Everybody's different. Everybody comes with their own complex set of struggles and needs, right? There's many toxic cultures out there, right, that need addressing. I also think there's many amazing cultures out there that have got some people in it who need to address themselves. So like both can coexist. Here's what I think. Most well-being and mental health people on LinkedIn will talk about the company being the issue. Go on Instagram, where they're running their person-to-person side of the business, and they'll talk about the individual being the problem. And the difference is who's paying the bills there.
Yeah, the company are buying the work on LinkedIn and the person's buying the...
So it's not to say that it's that simple, but that plays an influence.
Yeah.
So when I go into a company and I think you're doing all right, man, like I had one person at, recently at a big company, very big company, say to me, I feel like we've created a space where now people really feel like they can talk about their problems, right? And she said, and it's great, people are doing it. But I'm worried our managers aren't qualified to listen to that. And I said, what, you think your managers aren't qualified to listen to people's problems? She was like, yeah. I was like, fucking who told you that? What makes you think that? Wow, you know, they're not therapists. When did you need to be a therapist to listen to somebody's struggles? Because we live in a world now where there's lots of big corporate therapy companies that are telling you, you need therapy. If people are struggling, they need to come to therapy. And it's not that some people don't, like many people do. And it's great that these companies exist. And... not everybody needs them.
No.
Most of us intuitively know how to be with one another. But hypercapitalism's got its hands on emotions now. And, you know, it's become this space where it's like we're telling everyone you don't have what you need, so you've got to go out and buy it. But most people know what they need. Most people sometimes, the sessions I deliver, I give a reset. I say, listen, look, if you want to be successful in any aspect of your life, be that, and would define success in your job as getting to where you want to be in your job, yeah? There's going to be loads of other people that want to be successful too. What are you doing in the evening? I get an hour, right? I do my job, put the kids to bed, I get an hour. So I either walk through the door, be pissed off at the day that I've had, upset everybody, fall out with them, go to bed early, don't sleep because I've upset everybody in the house, and I drag all that shit from one day into the next day. Or before I walk through the door, I give myself 10 minutes. Let me take a shower. Let me make sure that I can be intentional in this evening because I want to go forth again tomorrow and be successful. So as individuals, we have to take responsibility. And when we feel uncomfortable, and there is mental illness, of course, and we should always check that it's not that. Otherwise, when you feel uncomfortable, maybe your body's telling you something. Maybe you're uncomfortable because your body wants you to be uncomfortable, because it wants you to be motivated to create the change in your life. When I worked in a factory, I was anxious and depressed every day. Every day. I started to feel like I didn't want to be here again. I'm 4 years sober. I don't want to be here anymore. I feel like I hate my life. I've got a therapist friend in Scotland. And she said to me, you didn't have a mental health problem. You didn't need a label. You had what I would call shit life syndrome.
She's in Scotland, did she say?
She, yeah. But she said you
there's
hated...
loads of us.
She hated you. I hated my job. Yeah. I had just enough money to get by, and if I wanted a little bit extra, I had to work on a Saturday and a Sunday. So I had to go to somewhere for 7 days a week that made me feel miserable. Of course you feel anxious and depressed all the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
You weren't expecting me to go here, was you, with this?
No, I'm happy that you did. I'm really happy you did. Because I think that's... We're speaking about... You can speak about companies or people. They're all just people that are going through these things. And I also like... I've always... The one thing I've taken from the conversations that we have is this overqualification of people to listen to a problem. I also liked what you said before on that, again, because two things can be true at once. You need to make sure that your cup has space in it to listen to those problems, which also means that you need to have the confidence to say and self-awareness to say, I feel like you need someone to listen to this problem and I'm not the right person to listen to that thing.
Mm.
Again, these are all things that managers could be taught quite quickly, actually.
Yeah.
Like, okay, managers, there's a three-part checklist when someone comes to you with a problem. Number one, are you in a position to deal with that thing?
Yeah.
And if you're not, you have to communicate that there and then.
Yeah.
Don't just sit through someone crying at you if you're not equipped emotionally at that moment to deal with that. Number two is what you've always said, which is don't go into prescription mode. Don't go into solution mode.
Yeah.
Straight away, as soon as you, I do that with my partner the whole time. Blokes, I think, are particularly bad at this. As soon as you hear a problem, you want to fucking tell a problem to go away and say, oh, I've got a thing for you, breathwork, or I've got a thing for you, Pixar films always gets me out of a, I think that's the second thing. I'm not sure what the third is, but those two things in itself for me are massive because I know that sometimes if I hear that someone's really not very well or upset or whatever, I always check and go, do I have the mental, emotional capacity to deal with that right now?
Mm.
And to be honest, a lot of the time I don't. Thank God I didn't sit and pretend that I did. Because I would have completely devalidated their problem. And they would have walked away and gone, oh, okay, maybe that wasn't worthy of, speaking about.
Exactly. And is it mine to witness? And is this the right space for it? HR people now have to be like marriage counsellors and therapists and all. Like it's like they need to be everything. And at some point we have to go, look, life's complicated, man, and it's hard. And the main body of my work is to try and make people be more compassionate, to have more empathy for the people around them. Yeah. And I want people to win in life as well. And you don't win by ruminating, man. You don't win by, at some point in my, what happens to me sometimes is because I'm an over ruminator. So I'm like, keep saying, let's sit down and go through this. Let's look more at it. Sometimes I'm in the car and I go to myself, I have to snap out of it. A metaphoric cold splash on my face and go, you know what? Stop workshopping this thing, man.
Yeah.
You've done it. Put it away now. And then I actively have to go, right. And I might put on like David Goggins in the car and listen to that. Because that's what I need in that moment. Because I need to be more like, fucking let's go. Man, I'm not gonna get pulled down by that thing. And if we just polarize and we go, just let's come over here and get deep in our shit and stuff like that, it can get warm and comfortable in your own shit.
Yeah.
So sometimes you need to pull yourself out of that, man.
Yeah.
But it's about understand, that's why all in the end always comes back to awareness. Where am I at? What's going on here? Am I looking to blame? Am I looking to push this onto my company? Am I looking to make this a work thing because I don't want to look at the fact that it's a marriage thing? Am I looking to make it a marriage thing because I don't want it to be a work thing? Whatever. Like, am I just shutting down and being completely avoidant because deep down I hate my life? That's the kind of work that people, that we all need to do. We need to come back to ourselves to have enough awareness to have, to risk saying it and risk exposing yourself to then try and find where you need to go.
We've reached the moment in this podcast where we need to finish.
I feel like I've ranted for about an hour, man.
I've loved it. It's exactly.
I always rant when I'm with you.
100%.
You know how to wind me up and then just set me up. Don't you? I'll ask him this. This will get him going.
Yeah. I'll just put 20p in there. Off he goes. No, mate, I've really appreciated this. It's been so nice because I get to... What I love about these conversations is everyone's allowed to have an opinion in this stuff. And sometimes I can sit in this chair, I've asked someone a question, and they're talking about a thing that I have no idea about. So hearing you speak about these things, I'm allowed to have an opinion. And I think that's a really important thing about doing these conversations. It's why I wanted to plug the book. It's Them Not You, Amazon, live on Thursday. $13.99. But also to speak to one of my top 25 best friends.
Fucking hell, I've dropped everything. Mate, I've just got to say before we finish, when I do the podcast here, when I do my podcast here, we have your man sat in here editing.
Yeah.
So I was just waiting for him to come in.
Oh, no.
So, like, I'm just fucking hammering everyone. And, like, you won't hear this if you're listening because no. I've made Ollie make sure that he stopped it. But I did about 5-10 minutes of just everything you asked me. I was just going, fuck, I don't know.
I thought, wow, he's brutal today. He's very brutal.
Recording.
Fucking hell. Well, look, man, I love you so much. Thank you for coming and doing this. And shalom.
Shalom.